Several years ago, when the Adult Enrichment Committee made the choice to shift our focus from classes led by volunteers to a program directed more by a paid member of staff, we also decided to actively engage in that time-honored idea which drew me to Unitarianism in the first place. The principle that there is much to be discovered by looking outside of ourselves. That delving into the beliefs of people who might be very different from us can offer insight, guidance, and depth for our own spiritual development. An acknowledgement that our own religion, despite its small pantheon of heroes, isn't the only kid on the block. This attitude is why, when Mark invited me to participate in today's service, I realized that to deliver a sermon with any depth, I needed to at least read this entire speech Martin Luther King Jr. gave the night before his assassination. I already knew his message was delivered on April 3, 1968, at the Church of God in Christ, located in Memphis, Tennessee. I even knew there were prophetic elements in King's words which many thought foreshadowed his death the following day. Yet what struck me the most were the things I didn't know.
Martin Luther King Jr. was a complicated leader and controversial. Most of us know about his civil rights work. Fewer know that 6 years after the Vietnam War began, King began to express his doubts, not simply because he was against all war as a moral position, but he could no longer keep silent about our government's policy in this specific conflict.
In a speech given on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year prior to the day of his death, King delivered his A Time to Break Silence speech at the Riverside Church in New York City.
Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in a time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world.
King felt that the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam was the first step in creating what he called an American colony. He reasoned that by supporting military engagement, our government was taking funds that could be better used for domestic programs, such as the War on Poverty, stating that
a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
Comments such as this cost King dearly. Union leaders, powerful publishers, even President Lyndon Johnson withdrew support. Life magazine called King's speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script from Radio Hanoi. And the Washington Post declared that King had diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people.
As Vicki has said, speaking out against the war brought serious repercussions. A Harris poll taken at that time showed that 73% of the American public disagreed with King's opposition to the Vietnam War, and 60% felt that his stance would hurt the civil rights movement. More disheartening was the fact that of all the African Americans polled, 48% felt that King was wrong.
Yet King remained steadfast in his insistence that the social justice issues he was fighting for were connected, that one could not hope to win in one area without addressing the other.
Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam. Now many people question the wisdom of my path.
Why are you speaking against the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining those voices of dissent? Peace and rights don't mix. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people?
When I hear these questions, I often understand the source of people's concern. Yet I am nevertheless greatly saddened, For such questions mean the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary in New York City.
Ministers are funny creatures. However elegant, they can also be theatrical performers, not always walking the talk, but dazzling us instead with their fancy word work. Dr. King's oratorical power is well known. Yet before he ever put on a clerical robe and stepped inside a church, King felt there were some things in this world that were morally unacceptable. War. The racial oppression of blacks in America. Poverty and unfair working conditions. King worked and fought for them all, not just in his sermons, but in his life.
We have moved from the area of civil rights to the era of human rights, a time where we are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole of society. We must see that the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together, and you really can't get rid of one without getting rid of the others.
Now, I don't know if you're like me, but if you are, you might have sometimes wondered what goes on in the mind of your pet, or your partner, or even your friends. And what about time travel? I've always found that idea captivating. And at least in this latter issue, King must have thought of that as well. Because he begins his last conversation with the American people, which became known as "I Have Been to the Mountaintop" speech, with a description of where he would travel, were God to grant him the option of choosing when and where to live.
I would take my mind back to the days of Moses in the crossing of the Red Sea. I would watch oppressed slaves flee from the land of Egypt.
King goes on to say he would take leave to visit the assembled thinkers gathered around the Parthenon in Greece. Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, Aristophanes. And in the style of some of our adult enrichment classes, he would watch as they discussed the great and eternal issues which confront humanity. But he wouldn't stop there.
I would observe the Roman Empire in the Renaissance and that vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln when he came to the conclusion that he must sign the Emancipation Proclamation.
And then, born minister that he was, Martin would also watch another religious reformer tack his 95 theses on the door of a church in Wittenberg. Yet as compelling as all these opportunities are, King emphatically stated that given the chance to live during any time and in any place, he would choose his own, even though he admitted it was a strange statement to make.
The world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land, and confusion is all around.
Yet, as Martin went on to add,
I know somehow that only when it is dark can you see the stars.
Later in this same speech, Martin Luther King shares how when he and his wife traveled to Israel, they rented a car and drove on the ancient road, which was the setting for Jesus' famous parable of the Good Samaritan. He shares how it is a twisty, dangerous path that begins in Jerusalem at an altitude of 1,200 feet above sea level and ends 8 miles later at 2,200 feet below sea level. During the days when Jesus roamed the world, it was known as the Bloody Passage, a place where people were hurt and robbed and killed, a road where people turned their back on those in pain. Martin doesn't pretend to know why the priest and the Levite refused to stop and help in that long ago story. Maybe
they were busy going to a church meeting or an ecclesiastical gathering, or they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late. Or maybe they were even on their way to help organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association.
More likely, though, Martin says, the people who didn't stop were afraid. That fearful for themselves, they couldn't see the I in the thou of a stranger. Martin seldom lost that ability himself, although on numerous occasions he struggled with depression. At one point, his wife Coretta was quite disturbed by her husband's state of mind, stating it was in more turmoil than she had ever seen before.
People expect me to have answers, and I don't have answers.
In this same doubting state, King went so far as to deliberately miss the plane that would take him to Louisville, where he was scheduled to speak at a voter registration rally.
I don't feel like speaking to people. I don't have anything to tell them.
Like Jesus' dark night in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he pleaded to his God, "If it is possible, may this cup be taken from me," Martin was being crushed under the burden of his ministry and his mission. And he didn't want to go on, particularly since he felt his nonviolence message was failing.
And then, in the spirit of another minister's wife I know, Coretta lifted Martin up.
"This is not so, Martin. You mustn't believe that people are losing faith in you. Millions continue to believe you are our best hope. And I believe in you, if that means anything."
"Yes, that means a great deal."
Following this conversation, Martin got on a plane and arrived in Louisville 7 hours late, but ready to continue the struggle. And following this, in other cities and in other speeches, he reiterated one of his most important messages, one that still rings true today.
"The question we should ask ourselves isn't what will happen to me if I stop to help someone else, but what will happen to them if I don't?"
Several years ago, the Adult Enrichment Program screened a powerful Spike Lee film portraying the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, which took the lives of 4 little girls. The movie showed how Bull Connor, who was the city's commissioner of public safety at the time, unleashed vicious dogs and sent them after black men, women, and children. And then he hosed these helpless people down as if they weren't even human. But King knew black people were familiar with water.
If we were Baptist or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodist or some others, we had been sprinkled. We knew water. That couldn't stop us.
And in a further response to the inhumane acts of Bull Connor, Martin went on to say,
"We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. We don't need bricks and bottles or Molotov cocktails. We just need to go to the stores and to the massive industries in our country and say, 'God sent us to say to you that you're not treating his children right.'"
Martin advocated economic boycotts to support change. He said the people of Memphis needed to stand behind striking garbage workers who were taking the brunt of low pay and appalling working conditions. And unlike some of our current pundits, Martin didn't talk about redistributing the wealth. He talked about redistributing the pain. To be willing to forgo our own pleasure so we could put our money where our mouths are. Martin encouraged people to develop, as he phrased it, a dangerous unselfishness in our defense of our brothers and sisters. "For
you may not be on strike, but we all go up or down together."
Several years after he made his last speech, Martin was stabbed by several years before he made his last speech, Martin was stabbed by a deranged black woman at a book signing in New York. The blade lodged dangerously close to his aorta, and his attending doctors told him he came perilously close to losing his life.
If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963 when the black people of Birmingham, Alabama aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream I had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the Great Movement. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that just now. I want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Last Wednesday, Martin Luther King Jr. would have turned 85. Tomorrow, we will officially pay our respects to a great man who died at the young age of 39. Yet as black educator Charles Willie has said, we must be careful. By idolizing those whom we honor, we do a disservice both to them and to ourselves.
There is a tendency to romanticize when looking back. Yolanda, the king's firstborn daughter, said,
"And in a way that only siblings can know, King's sister said, my brother was no saint."
As important as his moral example is, by putting King on a pedestal, we set him apart from our struggles and our own time, our own behavior. We separate his humanity from ours.
Martin Luther King Jr. was a real man who fought his own demons. But as a stalwart Christian who once thought of joining a Unitarian church, King also knew that,
"When I took up the cross, I recognized its meaning. We bear the crosses that we choose for our lives, and ultimately we die on them. This may mean the death of your popularity. It may mean the death of a foundation grant. It may even cut down your budget a little. But take up your cross and just bear it."
This is ultimately what King sought to do. He was unpopular, he was reviled, and for many years of his life, he was an enemy of the people. Yet despite the setbacks, despite the questions and the depression and the affairs of the heart and body and the burden of his hard work, Martin believed in his dream. And he wanted us to believe in it too.
To know that together we will be able to get just that much closer to the promised land.
That through our combined strength and our dedicated efforts, we will see stars in the dark of night and usher in the shining morning of a new world.